King Anye Howell of Youth Radio has learned his own hard lessons from being repeatedly profiled. He has a self-defense routine that he whips out at the first sign of a police car's flashing lights.
As someone who has been a target of racial profiling several times and was even arrested in front of my home and held in jail over the weekend for fitting the description of a burglar, I'm paying close attention to the White House Hops Invitational. People joke that I'm King Anye Howell, the king of getting pulled over, and they suggest that because I drive a Cadillac, I'm more susceptible to racial profiling. But I can say with confidence that Cadillac designers never said to each other, "Yes, with this year's model, we focused on a scientifically advanced design that will get people of color pulled over and searched." I've been pulled over in an assortment of vehicles, foreign and domestic, often searched and rarely ticketed. Heck, I've even been pulled over while on bike and even on foot, belittling the term DWB, driving while black. No, it's more like LWB. And getting a citation for living while black makes me feel like something less than a real citizen. For many black people, police scrutiny is a given and pretty institutionalized. But so is the F the police attitude that many people of color hold about the cops. Neither side gives. Once you've been unduly sidelined by police, you lose trust in them as both enforcement and protection. The protection you're paying taxes for. If you're a victim of crime, you don't call the police. If someone broke into my house right now, I say, "Dang, what do I do now?" And I've been profiled so often that I've almost developed an art form for asserting my rights while not offending the officer. I read recently that black men, when pulled over, have to be some odd combination of Samuel L. Jackson and Sidney Poitier, the former being known for his aggression and the latter for his eloquence. It may sound appalling to some, but that's exactly the tightrope I've learned to walk in dealing with the blue line of racial profiling. There's an unspoken understanding between the offending cop and me when I get pulled over. We both know it's not necessarily because a taillight is out or my music is playing too loudly, and we both know it will likely end up in some sort of search. I don't act indignant because I'm the Jedi Master, employing mind control to get us both out of the situation as quickly as possible. But once I've turned the corner, then I turn my music back up, because after all, that's why I bought it. If our forefathers had cassette decks on their horses, they probably want to play their music loud too. That's life, liberty, and happiness all in one action. That's the whole balancing act. I know how not to lose my cool and how to assert my citizenship at once. No matter the details of what actually happened on Henry Louis Gates Jr.'s front porch, there's again an opportunity for national acknowledgement of a divisive problem. It might take the form of increased candor about this issue from both police and the people of color who are wary of them. It might lead to some policy changes, like a racial profiling task force. And no matter what follows from the beer at the White House this afternoon, I don't doubt racial profiling will remain a sobering issue in my life for some time to come.
That's King Anye Howell. His story was produced by Youth Radio.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block in Washington.
And I'm Madeline Brand in California. Nearly a 500,000 veterans will attend college this fall, and now there's a new GI Bill to help them out. It provides billions of dollars in educational assistance for people who have served in the military since 9/11. Today, President Obama celebrated the bill with a rally at Virginia's George Mason University. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
President Obama's speech was short but replete with references to the original GI Bill signed into law by Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1944.
The GI Bill was approved just weeks after D-Day and carried with it a simple promise to all who had served. You pick the school, we'll help pick up the bill. And what followed was not simply an opportunity for our veterans. It was a transformation for our country.
By 1947, the president said, half of all Americans enrolled in college were veterans. 8 million veterans who were educated under the original GI Bill, Mr. Obama added, became the backbone of the largest middle class in U.S. history.
Including my grandfather. No number can sum up this sea change in our society.
The generation of veterans that have served since 9/11, the president said, can lead the way to a lasting economic recovery. It was that point that stood out for Jim Miller, the Marine who introduced Mr. Obama. It's what veterans can give back to this nation as civilians that's remarkable, says Miller.
For every dollar spent by the American government to send a veteran to school, it receives $7 back. And that's an amazing statistic to think about.
Miller, who served three tours in Iraq, will attend George Mason this fall. The new GI Bill provides full in-state undergraduate tuition and fees at a public college for 4 years, a housing stipend, and up to $1,000 for books. To qualify, veterans must have served at least 3 months of active duty beginning on or after September 11, 2001. National Guard and Reserve members who spent at least 3 months in Iraq or Afghanistan are also eligible. Over the next 10 years, the new GI Bill will pay out $78 billion in educational benefits. Still, the money may not go very far if a veteran chooses a more expensive private college, so some schools are pitching in. Michael Lockhead is Vice President for Administration and Finance at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Most of those students, if they chose Holy Cross, would be full-need students, in which case our policy is to meet 100% of demonstrated need.
Undergraduate tuition, room, and board at Holy Cross these days is over $49,000, says Lockhead.
What our program does is basically guarantee up to $18,000 in additional grants to the service member, and it's been our understanding that those grants would then be matched by the Veterans Administration.
But not every private college is putting up that kind of money, and this is causing some tension, which the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs says it can't do anything about. Members of Congress have already introduced legislation to help cover more of the costs at private colleges. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
Headlines from the U.S.-Mexico border are usually grim, but in fact, most people on both sides of that 2,000-mile frontier live quiet, normal lives. For the next 3 mornings, we'll offer snapshots of that life along the border. First, a man in South Texas who wants people to stop thinking of the Rio Grande as a river of fear. NPR's John Burnett reports.
I'm paddling a big orange plastic kayak in the middle of the Rio Grande. On my right is Texas, and on my left is Tamaulipas, Mexico. The banks of the river are thick with trees and bushes and cane and grasses. It's very calm and beautiful down here. You wouldn't know that we were paddling on an international boundary with a reputation for lawlessness.
That's the message that this man wants to get out to the world.
My name is Eric Elman. I'm the executive director of Los Caminos del Rio, and we're trying to change the way people see the Rio Grande and the Rio Grande Valley.
For more than 1,200 miles, the Rio Grande defines a boundary between two tense global neighbors, but it's still a river with amazing birds and lush plants and even a little whitewater. For 2 years, Elman has offered kayak trips on this stretch of river that begins on a Class 2 rapid below an irrigation dam.
This is like about as good a teaching rapid as I can imagine. You can see all this beautiful clean water just sweeping right at you. There's a little wave. You can get on it, get off it, be back in this eddy. Try it again.
Elman is an outdoor fanatic, a travel writer, and a former New York City bicycle messenger, who at 52 finds himself amid the grapefruit orchards and taquerias of South Texas promoting tourism on the Rio Grande. When he arrived in 2000, he found the cool river that bisects this sweltering land to be inviting, but no one else did.
They assume it's illegal, they assume it's dangerous, they assume it's dirty. I actually had one person ask, they thought it was electrified. You know, every reason in the world. And then they the local superstitions. There are whirlpools, the dangerous currents. Alligators. There was a huge alligator scare here last year.
When the locals realized that gators were not swallowing kayaks and the water is relatively clean, Elman encountered enthusiastic support on both sides of the border. Jeffrey Salcedo is a business promoter with the Mexican city of Reynosa, which is one of Elman's backers.
Quizá los que somos de esta parte, los mexicanos, tenemos una barrera. Perhaps Mexicans on this side think of the river as a barrier that's more mental than physical, because when we cross the river, we're accustomed to being detained and questioned. It's not so difficult to change this mentality because these water sports have been very successful. We just need to promote them.
Things are happening. Last November was the first annual Big River Festival on the Lower Rio Grande, featuring canoe races with 40 competitors from both countries. Now, the cities of Laredo and Nuevo Laredo upstream are sponsoring a 33-mile canoe race on their stretch of river as part of Rio Fest in October. Elman says he learned, to his surprise, the federal agencies that control and patrol the river welcomed boaters.
And it demonstrated to everybody who was watching that this is not only possible, but it's actually something that the powers that be encourage.
For its part, the U.S. Border Patrol is in favor of private watercraft on the Rio Grande, believing the more good people who use the river, the fewer bad people are likely to. Sonny Montes, a small business owner, recently moved from Seattle back to the Rio Grande Valley, where his family has lived for 150 years. Now, he's a regular paddler down here.
So what kind of reaction do you get from people in the Rio Grande Valley when you tell them you're going down to the river to kayak?
We're crazy because we're taking too much risk and it's dangerous. So, but you know what I tell them? I tell them we have the best security in the world because the Border Patrol has patrols in the air, they have patrols in the river, and they have eyes along the border.
The organization of which Eric Elman is director, Caminos del Rio, has long sought recognition of the cultural and historic importance of the Lower Rio Grande. Earlier this month, Representative Henry Cuellar from the Rio Grande Valley asked Congress to name the riverlands from Laredo to Brownsville as a National Heritage Corridor. But try as they might to make the Rio Grande a tourist destination, it remains the world's busiest border for drug smuggling, and that fact is unforgettable on the water.
Casey's standing on top of that truck.
A 16-year-old who's become an avid kayaker balances on top of the cab of a black pickup truck submerged in the gentle current.
So this is the truck graveyard?
This is one of them. Careful, Casey.
It's one of at least 30 sunken drug vehicles ditched by traffickers that's been identified in this stretch of river. Rio Grande visionaries hope that one day there might be more kayakers than drug smugglers. John Burnett, NPR News.
From kayaks to bikes, tomorrow NPR's Kerry Kahn paddles the streets of Tijuana.
Tonight, the implications of the Dow Jones averaging going past 9,000.
Charlie, auto sales are slowing, retail sales are slowing, job growth is slowing. The Fed will ease, interest rates are going lower. That will propel the market even higher.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average did indeed go past 9,000 last week for the first time since January. But that wasn't what Charlie Rose and Jim Cramer were talking about. That clip was from April 3rd, 1998, when the Dow broke the 9,000 barrier before slipping just below it by the end of the day's trading. Jim Cramer, now the sleeves rolled up, gag reel playing, gesticulating host of CNBC's appropriately named Mad Money, was fully confident in his predictions. But the point here isn't to pick on Jim Cramer. It's to take note of the change in tone and phrasing that he and many other financial pundits have adopted between the 9,000 breakthrough in 1998 and the one that happened last week. Listen to Cramer on his CNBC show last Thursday.
Do exactly what my late mom always said to do when I was winning at the tables, which is go out and buy a sweater with the profits.
In 1998, Dow 9000 turned bullish Jim Cramer into an even bigger bull. In 2009, Dow 9000 turned Jim Cramer into his mother's boy, Jimmy, all snug and warm in a new sweater. You're listening to NPR News.
And this morning, Judge Sonia Sotomayor officially became the first Hispanic justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. And she's the third woman. Chief Justice John Roberts swore her in during a brief ceremony at the court.
I, Sonia Sotomayor, do solemnly swear
that I will administer justice without respect to persons.
That I will administer justice without respect to persons.
And do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
and do equal right to the poor and to the rich.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams joins us now. Hey, Juan, what a historic event.
It really was. You know, there's a certain power to it that I hadn't anticipated in watching her take this oath. I think it's a reminder sort of, you know, what we saw with President Obama back in January. It's like the idea of, oh, my gosh, look at the possibility. Look at America, you know, making real these kind of ideals. And it, I guess it might sound a little corny to some, but it really does say to you when you see her hug her mother, a woman who, you know, raised her as a single mom in the projects in the Bronx, New York, that here's a poor kid who, through merit, really does it in America. It really is sort of heartwarming.
And especially against those rich wood-paneled walls in that Supreme Court chamber. And her mother was holding the Bible during her sermon.
Holding the Bible, her brother behind her. And then, of course, the words that we just heard in that soundbite, the oath that she took, again, spoke so directly to all the charges against her that, you know, she was going to somehow favor the poor or favor minorities. And here she was saying that, in fact, she'll administer justice without respect to persons.
So, and where do you come down on the debate over how she will affect the court? You know, some say, well, she'll turn it in another direction. Others say, no, she'll just, you know, it'll be more of the same. What would you bet?
Well, in general, I'd say that she's quite similar to David Souter, the retiring justice whose place she's taking. If there's one area in which I think that we could anticipate a difference, you got to remember that she has served 17 years as a district and appeals court judge, and she's been a prosecutor. That was her history. That's how she started out. So I think she may be tougher. I think this is going to come as a surprise to some, tougher on criminal law than David Souter was. In specific, there was a recent case in which Souter said that people who are technical experts, scientific experts in criminal cases, must testify and be subject to cross-examination. The expectation from most who've watched Sonia Sotomayor's career is that she would have said, no, it's not necessary.
Before we leave this topic, one of my favorite facts that I learned this week is that when she sits on the court, everybody will literally move, right?
Yeah, well, three or four of the justices have to move their chairs because there's this new junior member. She's the junior justice on the Supreme Court. And similarly, Daniel, when they're in conference and someone knocks at the door, she has to open the door. She takes notes. She speaks last. She won't even have an office because there's construction going on up at the court. So she'll have a temporary office for the next year.
So as the new justice, she'll answer the door.
Correct. As the junior justice.
But she won't have to serve coffee or anything.
No.
Okay. Well, let's turn now to health care. Okay, so Congress did not pass the legislation that President Obama wanted before the summer break. Not so surprising, right? No. But nobody predicted that the debate over health care would provoke physical fights, which is what happened this week in St. Louis. What's going on here?
Well, it's a little bit of both sides wanting to muscle up. One side, obviously, in opposition to President Obama's health care reform agenda, and that would be people who are aligned with Americans for Prosperity or the Tea Party Coalition. And I think they're being frenzied in some degree, fed into frenzy by polarized politics and also by polarized media. Talk about things like socialized medicine or rationing of medical care, especially to seniors. And you hear them saying things like, why, if Canada's healthcare system is so good, why isn't Ted Kennedy up there? All this kind of very angry, heavily weighted language. And the response from the White House and Democrats is, oh, we'll get the unions like SEIU, the Service Employees Union, we'll get AARP and supporters of the president's health care reform agenda to also attend these meetings. And then both sides are shouting and trying to drown the other out. So it's become very much an aggressive and angry scene, and in some cases led to the violence that you mentioned.
In 10 seconds, what do you predict? Will the Congress pass health care reform this fall?
Some form of it, but I don't think it's going to be anything great. It's more going to be a matter of a gradual change in how healthcare is reformed, and maybe we'll see incremental changes then down the road.
Juan, thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Dan.
NPR News analyst Juan Williams.
10,000 uninsured and underinsured people are expected to seek free medical, dental, and vision care this week at a former basketball arena outside Los Angeles. Volunteer physicians, dentists, and eye doctors will treat patients 12 hours a day for 8 days. This temporary clinic is set up by a group called Remote Area Medical. NPR's Howard Berkus attended the group's last clinic in rural Appalachian Virginia 2 weeks ago and has this reporter's notebook.
I write and talk for a living, but some of what I saw at the county fairgrounds in Wise, Virginia last month left me wordless. like the scene at the front gate at precisely 5:34 a.m. Friday, the first day of the remote area medical clinic. Guards had been handing out tickets all night, and the line of cars was a mile long. The next car in line would get ticket numbers 1599 and 1600, and they were good for eye care.
You got the last two tickets.
Last two tickets.
Four eyes.
That stunned the woman behind the wheel. She was speechless at first.
Ma'am?
Ma'am.
Ma'am, we're trying to tell you what you got.
Yeah, I'm going to give the two eyes back because somebody may need them more than me.
Okay.
Okay, thank you, ma'am.
Somebody may need them more. She figured there was somebody in line behind her more desperate to see an eye doctor right away. The dentists were already booked for the day, so she parked and waited 24 hours for the next round of dental and vision care. And there were plenty desperate to see dentists.
Yeah, we've actually gave out all the numbers that we can handle today for dental. Dental services are closed, I'm sorry.
You have to come back tomorrow.
Everybody who came back was treated during the 2.5 days of free care. More than 2,700 were seen overall. But organizers figured hundreds didn't come back because they couldn't afford the gas or another day paying babysitters or time away from work. In the office above the fairgrounds entrance, Nurse Teresa Gardner of a mobile free clinic called the Health Wagon told me that many people would probably have to wait a year for care.
For many patients, I think it is the only answer. It may not be the answer, but it is the only answer.
The only answer. I thought about that standing in the busiest place that weekend, the open-air dental pavilion, where more than 70 dentists pulled teeth, filled cavities, and performed root canals nonstop, 12 hours a day Friday and Saturday, and 6 hours Sunday. Close to 4,000 teeth ended up in buckets. Some 20-year-olds had every tooth pulled. A 4-year-old had every tooth filled. Out of the hundreds treated, only 11 had dental insurance. I arrived home from Virginia with a badly infected finger. It was swollen, red, and painful. With my insurance card and a $15 copay, my doctor took a scalpel to it and sent me to the pharmacy for antibiotics. All that took an hour. That's when these words came to me. I never felt so privileged to have a good job and good insurance and easy access to care without long drives and long nights and a year-long wait. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.